You're listening to Justice Radio on WMPG with Rob Ruffner from the Maine Indigent Defense Center, and today we're speaking with District Defender Frayla Tarpinian about the misinformation surrounding Maine's indigent defense crisis. But first, let's have Attorney Tarpinian introduce herself and what led her to one of Maine's first district defenders. Frayla.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. My background, so I was a law clerk, which led me to Maine, and then I was in private practice, first in the Midcoast in Brunswick, and then in Windham. I had a small solo or small practice doing criminal defense, protective custody cases, some family law. In 2013, I got the opportunity to join the district attorney's office up in Augusta, and so I came up here into Kennebec County, which is my work home and has been for a long time. And I worked on first the treatment courts and then moved over to working primarily on domestic violence and sexual assault cases. And I did that very happily. I became the district defender in 2018 and continued in that role. And as I was doing that, I could see some of the issues that were beginning to bubble in the indigent defense system as they sort of came through in the 20-teens and developed with COVID. And then when I learned that they were forming not just a rural defenders unit with kind of diffuse public defenders, but they were going to create brick and mortar public defender offices, I became very interested in joining that, coming back over to the side and working on that issue to make sure people in Maine have competent and, you know, quality legal representation on both sides.
Well, so we're glad that you have your white hat back on.
Yeah, people argue about the color of the hat I'm wearing all the time. I came back over and I haven't regretted it. I'm having a wonderful time. I'm meeting some really great people. I really believe in the work that we're doing. And I think that it's essential that Maine has developed a structure of a public defender's office. I believe passionately in that cause. Had there been a public defender's office, I think that's probably where I would have gone earlier in my career. But as that wasn't an option, I chose from the available options. And again, learned a lot of skills. Met a lot of really great people and have really enjoyed practicing law. But I definitely feel like I've come back home to where I'm intended to be and where I can put my skills to good use.
Well, we're glad that you're back with us.
Glad to be here.
So the, you know, Maine's indigent defense crisis, until recently, there was nearly 1,000 cases covered by PDS that needed counsel. That number has been reduced to not quite half, but it's stubborn. And it is frequently described as a shortage of public defenders, a shortage of attorneys is how it's unfortunately talked about in the media and by those in power, the judicial branch, the prosecutors, the executive, and even at the legislature. It's obviously more complicated than that. What would you sort of describe the bundle of issues that combine to, you know, create the storm that we're in now?
How much time do you have? There are lots of factors that contribute to, so sort of which crisis is the first question, because I think right now our court system is facing a number of different situations that are complex and detrimental. And because it's an ecosystem, kind of a closed ecosystem, if you will, all of these problems intersect. So into the indigent legal crisis specifically, so the shortage of lawyers, we can continue to yell at lawyers to take more cases. I think you've heard me say this before, but it's kind of like yelling at hens in the hen house to lay more eggs, because our eggs are, we have a shortage of eggs and the prices are really high. So if we just yell at the hens, maybe they'll lay more eggs. There's a finite number of skilled attorneys in the state of Maine. Skilled labor in the state of Maine is difficult to come by in multiple fields. So the legal field is not the only place where there's a shortage. It's kind of widespread. And that's a variety of reasons for that, having to do with the cost of getting a law degree, cost of living here, the wages that are available to people who practice in Maine. There's a number of factors that play into that. And so that's kind of why I was like, which problem do you want to talk
about? I guess.
Yeah.
We should talk about some other statistics. One that keeps coming up is the unrepresented number of individuals and or cases that need attorneys. And immediately people switch to not enough attorneys. But there's some other statistics that are out there, that there are significantly more criminal cases pending now than pre-pandemic, like close to 6,000 criminal cases that are pending. And yet only a small fraction of those are unstaffed with counsel for those individuals. The amount of work being done, you know, on commission cases has increased year over year. So there's more and more work being done during that time as well. Are some other statistics that are facts that are out there that aren't talked about. So you're right to point out which sort of crisis are we talking about. But in terms of the one that is affecting us and affecting how you're trying to build out your office and do your work, and or that you are accusations are tossed in your and your brethren's direction, your fellow defenders. You know, what are some of the other causes that led to those other statistics that we just mentioned?
There's a lot of different crises here that are intersecting. So I think if you think about what the public defense system is it delivers a service of a number of legal hours, if you will. So lawyers sell time, which is kind of invisible. So we write lots of paper, but it's time. The number of lawyers in Maine, has come down slightly since I think the start of the COVID, but it's not an enormous loss of attorneys out of the job. There's not been like an exodus of attorneys. There have been fewer attorneys on the roster, but I would argue that there are people taking cases mostly outside of the rostering system. And so the roster is not actually an accurate depiction of what legal services are available at any given time. And we can talk about all the things that factor into why that's true and why that's a commonly happening. We can talk about the backlog of cases. So we are not have back we do not have COVID cases hanging around. The 2020 cases are by and large gone. There might be a stray one here and there, but there are not cases from 2020 hanging around. But in the slowdown and stop of legal process that happened throughout 2020 and 2021, because again, all legal proceedings stopped for a short period of time, and then they slowly came back, but they came back at a much reduced rate. Those cases have backed up into this backlog. And so as we resolve the 2022 cases, we've resolved fewer 23 cases. And as we work on the 23 cases, the 24 cases are backing. So the time it's taking to resolve cases is lengthening. And that has to do with judicial efficiency, but also with the fact that we had a judicial system that was kind of running at maximum capacity into COVID, and they did not does not have the capacity to run at 100% plus the extra it would need to come through to bring that backlog down uniformly. And I would say there's an exception in York County that we should be looking at that is not being looked at carefully from what I can tell. The result of that is, and there were charging decisions made by prosecutors. There's also been some statutory changes that have reduced some of the criminal filings. The reduction in criminal filings doesn't do anything for the indigent defense crisis because the cases that have been selectively reduced in filings were not cases that were coming to attorneys by and large. They didn't stop filing assault cases. They didn't stop filing felony cases. They didn't stop filing serious cases. The cases which you see in a reduction in DA filings, because their filings have come down, they come back up, but they went down and up with COVID, were cases that would normally be non-risk of jail cases. So cases, which most cases in the system are non-risk of jail cases. So like
Can you
60% of
just
the
briefly
filings.
explain why that's significant?
If they're non-risk of jail cases, they don't get attorneys. So if you reduce the number of non-risk of jail cases you file, your statistics of filing will go down, but the number of defense attorneys you need to staff cases stays exactly the same. So it looks like there's been a reduction in filing of cases. There has been on hard numbers. The DAs can show you that in paper form, but they haven't stopped filing cases that require attorney services. So the need for defense attorneys hasn't been touched by the filings that have gone down. And so today in the county that I service, there's 87% increase in felonies than there were in 2019. So if my office existed here today in 2019, the number of cases, felony cases that would be pending would be significantly, almost 200 less cases. And so the number of lawyers required to staff 200 felony of cases, their time would be able to be spent doing something else. Or misdemeanor cases, cases in other counties, if they're contract counsel that do multiple counties. But when there's this backup of felony cases, and statewide, there's 65.8% increase in felony cases pending today than there was in 2019. It's not as of March 7th, which is my most recent numbers. That means there is a requirement for 65.8% more attorney time to be devoted to felony cases because felony cases almost always have a risk of jail. There are
Right.
no felonies that are not a risk of jail, in my opinion.
Well, and there's a, I think under Maine law still that felonies independently may trigger the right to counsel as well. So,
Correct. And misdemeanors, but I was going to finish my thought. Misdemeanors have still an increase as well, but it's much more modest. So there's a third more misdemeanors pending. Most misdemeanors are not risk of jail cases. And then the civil violations are down massively. Civil violations never have appointed counsel.
let me
That's
ask
part of
about the prosecute. You mentioned the prosecutors, and they're able to demonstrate their filings have gone down, and they make some decisions to maybe not bring cases that wouldn't have triggered counsel anyway. But when some in the prosecutors talk as if there's no discretion, they have no choice as to what to bring. But for example, if you have a shoplifting from Walmart, depending on the person's background, that could be brought as a, you know, if you've had two other theft type cases in the last 10 years, it could be brought as a felony shoplifting from Walmart, which triggers the right to counsel and potential, you know, real severe consequences despite what sentence is imposed for an individual. Or they could recognize maybe we don't have enough attorneys to staff these cases and I want to save them for violent crimes and then charge it as a misdemeanor where they're only looking for a fine. But prosecutors don't seem to talk about that. What's the sort of discretion that prosecutors have? Do they always have to charge the felony shoplifting from Walmart?
I think that would vary widely, and that would depend on the district attorney who is in that district and the policies that they set. So every district runs extremely independently based on their policies. So the district attorney in that office will set that policy. So in the office that I was in, we were given a great deal of discretion in cases and were encouraged to use that discretion. So filing the third offense shoplifting as a felony would be disfavored, typically. It was not something that we regularly did that because it was unnecessary. Necessary. I think that, in my opinion, when I was a prosecutor, I didn't deal with a lot of shoplifting cases. But if you are going to make somebody a felon, there should be conduct that really supports that. And, can you think of a third offense theft that might qualify? Sure. But like, if your third offense shoplifting is like, food staples from the local grocery store, that's not a compel. There's no compelling reason to make that person a felon. There are other ways to address whatever the underlying issues are in that case. And so, I believe that district attorneys have a lot of have enormous discretion. It's unfettered discretion, actually. What they convey to their assistants varies from district to district. But no, the idea that DAs have no choice in what they charge is false. They get to choose exactly what charges to bring. Do they have to bring the most serious, highest charges in every case? They don't. Should they be stretching on charges? So, we're seeing a lot of charging that there's charged up, these charges that are a stretch, and then these kind of safer, more obvious charges. The decision to push the boundaries on more severe charges is a tactic that, that's overcharging, essentially. If you can get a D, but you really want a B felony for the conduct, if you but the B is a lot, you don't have a lot of evidence of the B, you can throw them all on a complaint and there's no one to stop you. The only stopgap that we have is the jury at the end of the day. It's a fact finder who finds the facts not sufficient. But the choice to charge up in every case, that's a choice. The choice to charge every felony, every possession of fentanyl. Fentanyl is serious. The overdose crisis is real. People are dying. But the choice to charge every time someone hits a modest amount that's trafficking, the 6 grams, outside of the container, which you have to check what they're measuring, the choice to make that automatically the charge every time with the mandatory minimums and all the consequences that come with a Class A trafficking, as opposed to making it a reasonable amount or maybe some actual proof of trafficking rather than just a possession. Those are discretionary choices.
We'll come back to discretion in a second. You're listening to Justice Radio with Rob Ruffner, and again, we're speaking with District Defender Fraylor Tarpinian about the misinformation surrounding the indigent defense crisis. So there's discretion as to what charges to bring and at what level, if there's varying different types of charges or classifications of charges that could describe the, you know, could fit the conduct. But then isn't there a great deal of discretion that prosecutors have on how to conduct their case? What I mean by that is how readily do they give the defense everything they need, or do they draw it out and make the defense fight for every piece of evidence or report that they're entitled to? And also, do they hold out for sentences rather than accepting maybe not their first choice, but an acceptable sentence that would resolve the matter and then free them up to focus on other cases and free up counsel to defend other people?
Yeah, so how someone handles a case has a huge input into how long that case is going to take, how complicated it is. So we have a lot of discovery issues. I see it as a burden shift. I've said this recently to a couple of prosecutors. Like, prosecutors talk about how their caseloads are enormous. We can talk about that later, but the consequences of prosecutors having too many cases or choosing to file too many cases or DAs putting too many cases on a particular prosecutor means that they're not able to fully screen their cases appropriately, making good charging decisions, recognizing all the evidence, and ensure that their cases are complete. And so it's left to defense counsel to, because there's an exception in the automatic rules of discovery that say defense attorneys are, if they notice something missing, are supposed to request it. It puts the burden on us to ask them to complete discovery. And so in virtually every case that's come through my office, and most of the cases I handled at the DA's office, discovery is not complete when the case is charged. And discovery is not complete until defense attorneys ask for discovery. And then prosecutors are required to diligently search down those requests. But if they're inundated with cases and work, this is a place where they kind of will skip on it. And so these discovery violations have compounded the complexity and the length of time it takes to resolve cases. I think a really easy one. So, no court has held that not testing drugs at the beginning of the case is a discovery violation. But in order to prove a case where you have to prove the substance, so that would be a possession or a trafficking or a furnishing, you have to prove what the substance is as part of that case. They are not testing drugs in a timetable frame that has any, you don't have those results until very close to trial. And so you don't know that the state can actually prove that element of the offense. And it's kind of an all or nothing. If they can't bring that certificate to court, they can't proceed on the charges. And if they do bring the certificate to court, your client might very well be found guilty very easily, depending on the facts and circumstances of that case. But
And I guess I wonder how we got here in that regard. Back a million years ago, as a young, misguided lawyer, I was a prosecutor in the city of St. Louis. If an individual was arrested, they had to be charges filed in court within 20 hours. And we had a policy that they had to bring the lab results to our office within that 20 hours, or we were not going to charge the substance-related crime. And they were able to do that. The city of St. Louis was not a rich municipality, and yet they were able to do that. So it's just interesting that we've ended up at that point. But I want to talk about how it's interesting that they talk about, on the one hand, that their cases, they're inundated with cases, their caseloads are too high, they're doing the best they can. And on the other hand, they talk about, well, we've already taken all the appropriate action in terms of weeding out the charges that shouldn't be brought, and we've reduced our filings. How can you have more cases than ever before while you're saying that you're reducing the case filings? As an example of sort of how information is used for its own purposes, in front of the legislature or in front of the microphone for the news media. There's been a lot of discussion recently about public defenders and how many cases they're handling. Don Alexander, one of the commissioners of PDS, has been beating the drum to try to force attorneys to take more cases and practically suggesting that the public defenders are shirking their duties and not taking more cases. What do you think the end game? Well, first of all, just in a soundbite, respond to that myth. But then what do you think these parties are trying to use what is obviously an untruth? What's their end game?
I can answer some of those questions. So I'm not going to speculate as to what particular commissioners are doing or not doing, or what particular DAs are doing or not doing. I think most people right now are trying to evade responsibility for their part in this crisis. And so I know I've heard people want to focus all of the responsibility on defense attorneys as the reason that there's a crisis. And the reality is, this is an ecosystem. So the courts not functioning as efficiently creates a backlog of cases, which means cases take longer to resolve. The 6,000 increase in cases also weighs on prosecutors. The defense bar is carrying 5,000 extra cases plus the ones they're not covering. The prosecutors are carrying all those cases too with the same amount of people. Now they have 100 plus prosecutors. We have 25 public defenders. But that system can't handle the amount of extra that's hanging around. And case handling is part of that. How negotiations are going are part of that. Holding out for the highest and best result in every single case when you know they're going to break at jury selection is part of that process. Everyone wants to play chicken, but instead of coming to a re like, and it's not about winning, and it shouldn't be. it should be, you know, for a prosecutor, it should be coming to a right result. So if you can get the right result through negotiation, the faster you can resolve that case, the better for everyone, the system, the defendant, the victim, everybody. For defense attorneys and for defendants, it's really a choice about, is this offer what you would, do you think you're going to do better going to trial or this offer? Do you think there's a chance, or do you want to go? Sometimes defendants prefer to go to trial for other reasons that don't have to do with consequences. And that frustrates judges and prosecutors because they're not able to motivate them to do what they want, which is to plead. But defendants have no right. They have a right to a trial. They have a right not to plead and be heard on whatever reasons they want. And their reasons don't have to make sense to anybody else but them. And as defense attorneys, it's not our responsibility. It would actually be a violation of our responsibility if we're forcing people or heavily encouraging people to plea because it would be convenient for everybody. That's not our job. Our job is to represent our clients. Prosecutor's job is to do the right thing. And if people are too worried about their win or loss rate, that's a distraction about ego. It has nothing to do with anything anyone's supposed to be focusing on.
In terms of the theory that's been put out in the last couple of weeks that, well, we should just order, compel, make the district defenders just take a quote unquote full caseload. What impact, with you specifically, or if you want to just sort of generically, would forcing district defenders to not exercise their own discretion as to what best meets their job and ensures that they're doing their job and maximizes their office's capacity, but instead forcing them to take cases, what impact would that have on your office or offices generally?
Yeah, my office specifically, and I gave testimony to this extent, which is I have five attorneys who work for me. Two are experienced, three are in their first year. You know, now we're moving into their, you know, after their first year of practice. The two experienced attorneys can handle most cases, but have not handled all types of cases. So I have co-counseled with them on, for example, GSA cases, which are cases they haven't handled before. Those are gross sexual assault cases. They're have up to lifetime of incarceration, and they're serious sexual offenses. It takes some experience to do those cases. But my other attorneys who are not doing those quite yet, although they're getting close, are handling, for example, class A trafficking cases. They would not be able to handle those cases if they were in private practice. They handle those cases because I co-counsel officially in some of them as an enter my appearance in some of them. And in other ones, I have not entered my appearance, but instead I provide a great deal of support, which means, you know, what it means I review the file myself. We talk about motion practice. We prepare for motion practice. It means I review questions for cross-examination for motion practice. I attend all motions of those hearings. So even if I'm not technically a co-counsel on some of those cases, I am in effect co-counseling on those cases. So if you the choice is easy, I can take how many ever serious felony classy cases I can handle. You know, we can argue about what that number should be, but it's not a whole lot over 20. If we're talking about class A sexual assaults, which is primarily what my caseload consists of, or I could manage three others who are helping me do that with the other two, and we can handle a whole lot more. So I can handle a higher volume of the cases that people are on that in custody list without counsel or on that list waiting for counsel when I am functioning as a supervisor and assisting five other people taking those cases, taking a couple. I don't have, I only have one case that's on my own. I always co-counsel with people because my job is really, as I see it, is to supervise and train these folks to do cases. Because in a couple of years, if I have five attorneys who can handle anything that comes in this office, our capacity is going to be at the maximum it can be. If I, however, spend the next 3 years just doing my best practice and taking full caseloads, I'm going to relegate these younger attorneys to learning on cases that are less serious with less serious consequences, which will look more like private practice. So it'll take a couple of years for them to get through OUIs and simple misdemeanors and simple felonies until they graduate into misdemeanor DVs and they start doing those cases. But instead, I've chosen to try to get them up to speed as quickly as possible because
So,
five people could take more cases than one person.
right. So, what are the implications of the people that are parroting or shouting or propagating, if that's even a word, this misinformation? Is that it could actually negatively impact how many cases a defender office could handle by diverting and overriding the best judgment of the district defenders. And I wonder if you have any theory that there's other potential downsides to people talking or about this using this information for their own purposes, such as the recent incidences of assistant district attorneys and district attorneys harping on defender caseloads in contexts that have nothing to do with really anything I can see, sort of like that there seems to be a bitterness that has come out from this information that has infected the prosecution almost. You have any thoughts on that?
And there's a trope that it's been bandied about for years about how lazy defense attorneys are and how they're only out for making as much money as possible and they don't really do very much. And so they're harping on this trope, which is true. It's a
Wait,
trope
wait,
about all
wait. I
lawyers,
could have made money?
not you.
Okay.
But they're playing on this trope of, this grass is greener, like, we just are doing whatever, God knows what with whatever time we have. But the reality is, we feel the sense of urgency more than anybody. And we are doing our best to take it together. I would also like to say my office has been in existence for 15 months, and I have five attorneys, all of whom came in with some experience. The other offices, we still have offices who don't have furniture, who got internet in the last couple of weeks. So when you compare an office that has come up and running in the last few weeks as opposed to the last year, it's not a fair comparison. And also, most of the offices did not come in with the level of strength that my attorneys came in. That's nothing against the other assistant defenders, but they came in with either less experience or from other jurisdictions, which is different practices. And they're not allowed to practice until they're released under the bar rules for a temporary practice, which is a recent development. And so I think when you compare our offices, if you think all of the offices have been functioning like my office for 15 months, you're doing them a great disservice and you're expecting more than they could ever possibly be expected to deliver. But if you took me back to February of last year, March of last year, when I was running this office out of a building that wasn't functional off a spreadsheet because I didn't have case management software, we weren't taking the number of cases we're taking now. We had a much reduced caseload. But give them time. I think people need to back off their expectations and their desires to make these offices solve their immediate issues and allow them to develop into what they have the capacity to be. And you will unleash extremely strong solutions and resolutions for a lot of the issues in the system. We can't solve everything. We're only a third, we're only built for to be a third of the system. We have less than a quarter of the number of prosecutors,
I
right?
would like to talk about that future with you in the future. Perhaps we can talk about what the public defender system could be and be built out to in a future episode. I know that you're very busy, and we're almost out of time here. And I'm obligated to say thank you for listening to Justice Radio. Tune in next time, and a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series. And a big thank you to District Defender Freyla Tarpinian.
Thank you so much for having me.